History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And hopefully the next hour is evidence that they don't have to go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so the rest of us never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you've ever seen the documentary Honor Flight, and if you haven't, you should check it out, but a Wisconsin veteran named Joe Demler shared this memorable quote: "Every day is a bonus." And there are reminders of that truth surrounding us daily. Our plans for this week's episode took a turn when I caught wind of the passing of two very impactful veterans, one in California, one in New Mexico, both from families that epitomized a spirit of service and both of whom left indelible marks on their communities. We're going to start with Walter Granger, a lifelong educator who called Bakersfield, California home for his entire life, except for his Navy service in the Pacific in World War II. His legacy includes the Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial, which he described for us here on Hometown Heroes before it became a reality.
The thing we're trying to do is to make it a little different. I say that it contains seven different elements. We're going to memorialize those 684 Kern County veterans who gave their last full measure, and we're going to put those on the front side of one of the six black granite slabs that are standing vertically across the back of the memorial. They're 4 feet wide and 6 feet high, 8 inches thick, and so they're very impressive. And across the front side will be engraved, and one of our members will be doing the engraving. On the other side, people are paying $250 to honor one of their relatives who served in the service and came home. So we're going to memorialize those that passed away. We're going to honor those. Most of those have passed away now, but they came home. Another element, just below the list of the 684, we're going to have two timelines, educational timelines, that show the main events from the beginning of the war to the end of the war for the Pacific Theater. And we're going to do that with etchings. And then below that, there will be a text to describe that. Immediately under that is another timeline just for the European theater to do this very same thing. And that's really a challenge to find good pictures that can be engraved and then to verify exactly what's happening. I'm scared to death that we're going to say something about some activity that somebody's going to say, well, that isn't right. And so we're not looking at one source, we're looking at several sources, and hopefully we'll accomplish that. One of the big problems is we're trying to do things that affect locally. We want to make sure that those are in there. Like, for example, when the Japanese Americans were hauled off in the middle of the night with their belongings in a suitcase, they were hauled off down to L.A. and then moved on a train to Poston, Arizona. That was in the spring of 1942, and they didn't come back until—and we don't know if they all came back, but came back in 1945. And to get the exact information, how many left, and all that kind of thing, because I saw them disappear, the kids on the track team. And the people in your class, they just disappeared, and they never really talked much about it. Right across to the front of the memorial will be four pedestals, which will depict those people and those activities that were active at the home front that kept the thing going. We kind of made the impression locally about that when we had a USO show at the local dinner theater, which came off really great. Full house, lots of people, lots of good food, lots of stories. We're having lots of fundraisers. And in the center between the six slabs and the four pedestals, we're going to have a life-size mother or wife, however you look at it, standing on a 5-foot pedestal, life-size. She's holding her toddler with one arm. She's leaning over like she's in agony and in throes of tears. There's tears running down her cheek. In her right hand, she's holding the dreaded Western Union telegram. The War Department regrets to inform you. So many people got that. Around the border will be a slanted portion because the base of the memorial is raised 2 feet, and so there's an angled portion around the edge.
Whose concept was that, that you just described and laid out? Where did that come from?
Well, it was mine. I gave a big pitch about the kind of thing that I just said, that to try to make it different. Like, for example, the timeline. You won't find very many memorials with timelines on them. You won't find very many memorials, actually, that have the contributors. I've worked on more than one memorial, not necessarily a veterans memorial, but a memorial. And 99% of the time, when you're donating money to build the structure and want to honor someone, it's been a brick that you walk around on. And in one situation, trucks actually drove over them and broke them. And so we wanted to get away from that concept. And one of the other fellas, I didn't come up with that idea, to have the big slabs like they are, and on one side have the memorializing, and on the other side have the honoring. And it's worked out very well. My family received a telegram. My brother, one of my brothers, was not killed in action, but he never came home. He got sick and died. And so he's not memorialized, but there's going to be 5 Granger boys who were in World War II who are honored on the backside.
And that's what strikes me as I hear you describe this, is that you feel the need for each one of these elements. The need to honor the 684 from Kern County who died, the need to recognize other veterans who served, the home front, and that statue that you described of the mother holding a child receiving the telegram. I'm sure that's going to be an emotional sight for a lot of people who visit it. You know, you mentioned your oldest brother getting drafted right after the war started, but I'm interested in that. You know, the start of the war, Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember how you found out about that, where you were and how that unfolded?
We were getting ready for church. My dad and the older boys had built a big sleeping porch on the back of the house, so that all of us kids were in the back getting ready for church, and it came over the radio, and we said, oh my gosh. And then naturally, everybody at church said, what's going to happen? And we heard FDR on the radio, and that was it.
You mentioned also that the second of the 6 boys in your family passed away during the war. What can you tell me about that? How that happened, when that happened, and where were you? Because that couldn't have been easy for you.
The way I found out, first of all, we knew that he was very healthy all of his life. So when we heard that he was not well, we were all surprised. The way we found out, it was in July, and my folks like to go to the Long Beach area. So they and the baby were off on vacation, and I was home alone. And a taxi cab drove up in front. The guy rang the bell, and I thought, what in the world is this all about? He must be lost and wants some direction. And he handed me the telegram and turned away. And I opened it, and it said, sorry to inform you that your son, Edwin, has passed away at Sawtell Hospital. And I thought, holy Toledo, what am I going to do? I don't even know where my folks are. They're down in the Long Beach area. So I tried to think of a place where they had been before. And then I had to find a phone number. And I found a phone number of a couple of places where I thought they had stayed before, and left my number and called me ASAP. And then waited, and finally, I don't know, I have no recollection of how long it was, but it wasn't the same day. Dad called and said, what's happening? And in between that time, I got a phone call that they wanted the folks to come by to figure out what to do to this Sawtell Hospital. And it ended up that the folks went there and decided to bury him there in the Sawtell Cemetery across the street from the Sawtell Hospital. Naturally, we all went down there to the service, and it was kind of a dingy area, but they felt like that was the thing to do. There was a veteran section there. Subsequent to that, as we've gone back, they still didn't do very much, but what are you going to do? And then when they put the National Cemetery here, I thought, well, the thing to do is to go back down there and talk to them and find out about moving him up here. Well, in the interim, in the 70s, the U.S. government took over the Sawtell Cemetery and now called it the Los Angeles National Cemetery. It looks like a miniature Arlington. It's just beautiful. And we went down and they were just setting up all the digital information so anybody could find out who's there and where they are. One gal was super nice. She told us how to get there, and one of the guys said, well, don't tell them how to get there. I'm going to take them over there. And we went over, and the dingy area was no longer dingy. It was really nice. So we came back, and we drove through, and it was just a magical transformation. It was just beautiful. And so I told the gal, I said, well, we're going to go home and talk about it. And I said, can I hug you? And she said, I've never been hugged by a World War II veteran before. And I said, thank you so much. They were so gracious.
Yeah, that's right off the 405 freeway there in West L.A. It's a beautiful spot to visit, and more special for someone who's got a personal connection like you do. And I can't imagine what that must be like as a teenager to get that telegram and then to be the one responsible for informing your parents. What were you able to find out about what happened to him and how he got sick and why it took that turn?
Well, they said he had rheumatic fever, and had evidently the connection between rheumatic fever as a rheumatic heart. In those days, they evidently didn't know much about it. And still to this day, you don't hear much about a rheumatic heart or rheumatic fever.
And he had been serving in the Navy?
Yes, he was in the Navy. He and number three was at Berkeley and became a 90-day wonder. And number four and he and another friend, they all joined together at the same time. Do you know what a 90-day wonder is?
Absolutely. Usually it's used with a bit of a pejorative sense from those who had to serve under the 90-day wonders, huh? They became officers in that time.
Yeah, well, right. They made them an ensign right away. The worst part was that some of them thought that they were war-experienced seamen and did not hit it off at all with the crew. But we had a couple 90-day wonders aboard, and they were fabulous kids, just like I'm sure my older brother was, that they fit right in. They didn't try to put anything upon the regular men that had been in the Navy for years. So it was a big joke.
And as far as Edwin's story, what was the ship that he was on?
He wasn't. He never got on a ship, Edwin.
Because he got sick before he could be assigned?
Correct.
There's a project right now that I've talked about a few times on this program that's called Stories Behind the Stars. When they say the stars, they mean all those gold stars in Washington, D.C. at the National World War II Memorial, which you've been to, that represent well over 400,000 Americans who died during World War II while serving in the armed forces. And it wasn't necessarily that they died in action, but they died. And so you're telling us one of those stories behind the stars in your older brother, Edwin. Have you ever thought, in all these years since, what his life might have turned into? What he would have been like if he'd had the opportunities that you and your other brothers had?
Oh, definitely, because he was very mechanically inclined. He would have had a business somewhere. As we grew up, all the kids had old cars. If the folks changed cars, well, then the 1926 Essex Terraplane that the folks had became our car. We were the terror of Oildale, climbing the hills There was enough kids to put some more weight on the back of the car, and we could outclimb lots of cars that looked like they were better than we were, but that old Essex really climbed those hills in North Oildale.
And here, you've lost a brother. You've got three other older brothers who are in the war. What made you say, hey, I want to sign up? I want to go in the Navy before they draft me.
Well, there wasn't any second thought. Dad was in the Navy in World War I. The emphasis, naturally, then was one for the Navy, all for the Navy. The baby was in the Navy in the Korean War. So there was all six boys served in the Navy in wartime. I've often said I'm one of seven Granger boys who served during wartime in the armed forces and proud of it.
So that's your dad and his six sons.
Correct, yeah. My folks were very patriotic, had flags all the time. Matter of fact, my mother's immigrant parents, German, named her Alice Liberty Jensen because she was born on the 4th of July.
I don't want to forget to ask you, though, about your trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Kern County to see the National World War II Memorial and other sites that I'm sure were meaningful to you. Was there something in that experience, that journey with fellow veterans and volunteers that was most meaningful to you?
Well, it was just one tearjerker after the next. I was fortunate. The fifth grade at Thorner Elementary collected the money, cookie sales, and the parents and the kids of the whole school put $1,500 together to pay my way. Oh, I had a fabulous weekend. Every place we went, there was hundreds and thousands of people yelling and screaming congratulations, and kids who could hardly walk to people with canes.
What did you think about at that memorial when you looked at that wall of gold stars that represents over 400,000 Americans in World War II who didn't get to come home?
When they tell you how many that represents, it really brings it home. It isn't just a number. I mean, it's a field. What are they, 6-8 feet high for a half an acre out there? And that's why we're trying to have some, we're having some stars at the top of each of the black granite slabs. There's going to be a medallion for each service. And in the center of that medallion is going to be a gold star. So we want to pick up the same feeling.
And I promised you I was going to ask you this, because this memorial will be unveiled on Veterans Day, November 11th, as long as people get it done, and you still need some money to finish it. And I hope people listening will chip in, and they can look at hometownheroesradio.com for a link to how to do that. A year from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, when someone comes through Bakersfield and they drive down the Avenue of Heroes and they come to this Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial, what do you want them to experience? What do you want them to come away with?
I want them to have the feeling that they're very fortunate that all this had to happen. It had to happen because we had to protect our freedom. We had to go. We've never gone somewhere to conquer. We've only gone there to keep people from coming here to conquer us. We've always gone to help somebody else who's trying to be conquered. And to recognize the fact that just from Kern County, the 684, that included one woman, and the one woman was married to another person who was killed. They weren't together. They were in different places, but they were man and wife. And the fact that it could happen again, particularly if we don't straighten out and realize what a democracy is and how it can work. Everything is so politicized, it's just criminal.
So I just have one more question for you. If there's anything else that you want to add, feel free. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country in World War II. And thank you for the way you're serving your community and your fellow veterans now. I know a lot of people are touched by that. When you look back over your life, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Family, my family. My family has been my life. I'm just one lucky guy.
The late Walter Granger. And if you really want to soak in the impact of his legacy, pay a visit to that Kern County World War II Veterans Memorial the next time you pass through Bakersfield, California. When we come back, another impactful World War II veteran who passed away this week at the age of 99, 80 years after being shot in the head on Iwo Jima. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode honoring two special World War II veterans who completed their earthly assignments after 99 years on our planet. We focused on Walter Granger's impact in California's Kern County, and now we shift our focus to Rio Arriba County in New Mexico, where as a farmer, a firefighter, a game warden, a philanthropist, Carl Berghofer touched the lives of many. But the last 80 years of his legacy were inches away from evaporating on the volcanic sands of Iwo Jima. Before we hear that part of his story, let's explore his motivation for leaving high school to join the Marine Corps in 1943.
Well, my brother-in-law was a Marine back during the Nicaraguan campaigns. We discussed which branch of service. He says, if you want to get good training, go to the Marines. If you want to have an easy life, go in the Army. So I enlisted the Marine Corps, and I was called up in July. The quota was full at the time I enlisted. And I went to Parris Island for boot training and in the Cap Lejeune for advanced training. And I shipped overseas almost 6 weeks. I had 3 weeks of boot camp for 6 weeks of advanced training, and then I shipped right overseas.
Wow. Hurry up and go, huh?
Yeah.
What was it like going through boot training and all that? Well, did you feel prepared for it already?
It was different.
Yeah?
They had the old Marine Corps boot camp was real intensive training, lots of discipline. And I didn't mind it much because I had been raised in that kind of conditions a lot. So It wasn't anything particular new, but it was strenuous.
Did you have any idea what to expect when you shipped overseas?
Yeah, I knew what to expect. My cousin had been captured on the Bataan, went through Bataan Death March, and he died at a concentration camp in Japan of slave labor up there, and he was my aunt's pride and joy. So I had already made up my mind I would never be captured by the Japanese.
So that happened. He was captured before you enlisted.
Yeah, he was captured and died before I went into service.
And you knew he was dead already, or you didn't know?
We got a report from the Japanese that he had died, but we didn't know till later what he died of. And he died of malnutrition, starvation, dysentery.
What was his name?
Harlan Bickford.
And was he from New Mexico also?
Yeah, he was raised out here in Boodle. Yeah. I bought a place down there to build a house on it. And at the same time, my mother and dad were building up this place over here next door to us. The place my son's living now.
So you had known him pretty well?
Yeah, well, we were real close friends. He was a little older than I was.
And he was Army or?
He was in the Army. He was in the 200th Coast Artillery.
So many from New Mexico were in that unit. That's why
there
are more from New
Mexico. People in it.
More from this state than any other state on the Bataan Death March. How did that impact you when you heard that news that your cousin had been killed?
Well, that was what I made up my mind. I would never be a prisoner of the Japanese. But when I went overseas, we got in the tail end of the Battle of Guam. We went in as replacements and got in the tail end of the Battle of Guam. And that was a real serious campaign. The main party had already ceased, and we were mopping up remnants of the Japanese army that had holed up inland. The Japanese survived on Guam for a long time. The fact is, the last Japanese on Guam surrendered about 1970, been living off the land and holding up inland.
So what kind of things did you experience there at Guam? I mean, this would have been your first...
It was jungle warfare and lots of cliffs and caves and so on in the backcountry. We were mopping up the remnants of the Japanese army on Guam. We got a lot of combat, but nothing really serious, nothing like we ran into when we went to Iwo Jima.
But it gave you a taste anyway, right?
Yeah.
The stakes that were in order?
Yeah, it gave us a taste of combat.
You told me you made up your mind you'd never be captured.
Yeah, that was my greatest fear.
More so than being killed?
Yeah, I was more afraid of being captured than I was of being killed.
What were the other guys you served with like?
They were a nice bunch of guys. I had George Cage from Durango, Colorado, and Bob Bell from Okmulgee, Oklahoma, and Bert Jane from Missouri were in the same fire team. We went through boot camp together, went overseas together, in the same fire team on Guam and the same fire team on Iwo Jima. Of the four of us, there was two of us were wounded, and none of us were killed.
That was no small feat, given the odds that were working against you, especially on Iwo.
Yeah, we went to Iwo Jima. We had a full company of men, of 240 men. At the end of the campaign, there was 11 of the original men still active.
Who served on Iwo Jima, who fought in that battle.
Yeah.
Most of them had never heard of Iwo Jima before they got there.
Yeah, well, I never had heard of it.
Did you know where you were going when you headed that way?
Yeah, we found out aboard ship going up to Iwo after we loaded to Guam and went up to Iwo Jima, and they announced on the speaker system we were going to Iwo Jima. We got up there, and the 4th and 5th Division were the first waves ashore.
Right.
And the 5th Division went across the island, cut it in two, and then turned north on the west side, and the 4th Division landed on the east side of the beach and went up the east side. The 3rd Division was in reserve. My division was in reserve, and we went ashore on D+1. The evening of D+1, the 4th officers were suffering heavy casualties, and we went in to replace them, and we went up the center of the island.
You know, it's been famously said that the estimates were it would only take 3 days to take that island. Did they tell you guys that?
We were there for more than 30 days.
Well, and I imagine if they thought it was going to be over in 3 days, they probably didn't think they'd have to send the reinforcements in as early as you guys went in.
Yeah, we went in early.
And what did you see? Can you help us understand what it was like for you?
We watched it from the ship, and it was just a cloud of smoke and dust and bombing and artillery shells. And then when the Marines went ashore, well, they landed almost unopposed. And after they got ashore, then the Japanese opened up on them and tried to hit them at the beach. They hit a lot of the shell fire, hit a lot of the landing boats, LSTs and Higgins boats, and the beach was cluttered with torn up, destroyed ships. And we went ashore. We couldn't get to the beach, so we unloaded on an LST and climbed the rope ladder into the LST and then went off the ramp to get ashore.
Because there wasn't enough room from all the...
Yeah, all the wrecked vessels.
Wow.
They had boats in there trying to tug the boats, wreck shell boats out off the beach.
You guys were going in a Higgins boat, in an LCVP, and then couldn't make it in?
We were going right at the heart of the shell fire on the beach.
I can't imagine what that must have felt like, to see all that in front of you and wonder what's going to happen to you.
Iwo Jima was, I still have dreams about that damn place. It was black sand and pumice. You'd take a step going up the terraces onto the beach. It was a series of terraces that were wind and water formed. You'd take a step up and you slide back a half a step. The only way you get up the terrace is get down to your hands and knees and crawl and get up one terrace and take shelter and rest, and then you climb the next terrace.
And meanwhile, and there's still incoming fire.
Yeah, we were under fire the whole time. But we made it up on the beach, and then we captured some of the Japanese foxholes and so on. And we went ashore. I'll never forget the smell. There was two smells I've never outlived. The smell of rotting dead bodies and blood, and the smell of sulfur. The whole island that was named Iwo Jima because it was Sulfur Island, and it supplied a good part of the sulfur for the Japanese armament. The whole island stunk of sulfur, and the center of the island was an extinct volcano, and then the volcano on the south, Mount Suribachi, that's the one they raised the flag on. I was on the beach when the flag went up, by the way. But the northern part of the island, you dig a foxhole down and dig those sulfur pumice bricks out, and they'd be plumb hot. They were hot enough to heat your K rations on.
Wow.
The smell of sulfur permeated the whole island.
Doesn't sound like a very comfortable place to be.
It sure wasn't. They had three airstrips on the island. The reason we took it is capture those airstrips,
right,
and make a landing strip for returning B-29s coming from Japan, bombing Japan. We also put fighters on there to accompany the B-29s clear to Japan, give them fighter cover.
And that's something that some have debated over the years. Some have suggested, yeah, did we really need to take that island, especially at such a heavy cost?
Yeah, it was heavy cost.
And you, here you are, 18 years old.
Yeah, I just turned 18, about 18 and a half when I went to Iwo.
And you're seeing things you've never seen before.
Yeah, I got used to it in a hurry.
And you said something. You were on the beach when the flag went up.
Yeah, I was on the beach when the flag went up, and we were under shell fire. And the ship's whistles all went off all around the island. All the ship whistles went off, and we looked up, and they had raised the first flag on Iwo Jima. It was a little flag. You could barely see it. They raised two flags. The one in the picture was the second flag.
Right. Did you see that one go up as well?
Yeah, I saw it go up as well.
Yeah, the story goes that James Forrestal, Secretary of the Navy, wanted the first flag as a personal souvenir, but Marine Lieutenant Colonel Chandler Johnson wanted to make sure it stayed with the 2nd Battalion, 28th Regiment, 5th Marine Division, that had made its way up Mount Suribachi to plant that flag. So Johnson issued orders to have a replacement flag sent up, and of course he said, make it a big one.
He thought the first flag was too small. It wasn't very big. I would say it was probably 3 by 4 feet.
And you said the ship's whistles were going off because they're all watching.
Yeah.
And they see this flag, and that signifies
we were permanent in possession of the island.
So for you, being on the beach and seeing that, what did that mean?
It was a big morale booster, believe me.
Did it come to register as a bit of false security as well, though, because of there was so much battle left to fight?
No, well, it gave us we knew we were firmly in possession of the island at that time, but we knew there was a lot of hard fighting ahead of us, and there sure was.
Because you had basically another month there after that.
Yeah.
What was that month like?
We made the assault on the second airstrip, my unit did. That was a bloody mess. The Japanese were dug on the other side, and we charged that airstrip, got across it, and captured the first trenches and trenchments. And I remember looking back, and there was dead and wounded Marines all across that airstrip. They got a lot of our people. After that, we had cover. That was the only uncovered attack we made, was across the airstrip. But the rest of the campaign, we were just one ridge and one foxhole to the next. We'd move ahead. Maybe take 50 yards in a day. Then at night, we could lay in our foxholes and we could peel the vibration of the Japanese, digging out the caves underneath us. And the next day, there'd be as many Japanese behind you as there was in front.
Wow.
They had that whole island riddled with tunnels. You could go from one end to the other of that probably seven different ways and never go through the same hole twice.
Which makes it pretty difficult on you, I imagine.
Yeah.
And it sounds pretty exhausting.
We'd burn out, with flamethrowers burned out the tunnels and the caves we found, and then dynamite them shut. And that next night, the Japanese be digging them out and open them up again.
And you did some of that?
Yeah. I never did operate a flamethrower. I was a rifleman, but I'd carry shape charges and Bangalore torpedoes. Mm-hmm. They were real effective against the caves.
I'm just imagining being in your shoes, an 18-year-old kid dealing with all this.
Yeah, I got a rude awakening on Iwo, believe me.
Well, and it sounds like you never know where the enemy's coming from.
You never knew where they were coming from, and they were really dug in. We'd maybe make 50 yards a day, and then toward the last of the campaign, we made a night assault through the Japanese lines to the North Beach, and I was in the party, and we had about 18 or 20 men, made the transfer through to the North Beach. Our objective was to cut off the 4th and 5th Division that already completed the assault through the two flanks, right and left side of the island, and the 3rd Division was pretty well through the center of the island, but the Japanese had runners going back and forth to keep communications going between the right flank and the left flank. We went in there to break up that runner, and they covered us up that night. We were dug in right on the cliffs on the northern beach, where we could look right down to the ocean, and the Japanese covered us up that night. That was the only night I knew I was going to make it home. But we held them off that night, and then the next morning the Marines advanced up on the top of the ridge above us, and they could fire down in there, and the Japanese withdrew.
So if they hadn't done that, you were surrounded, and you really had no way out of that.
Yeah, we had no way out of it. That was the only night I really gave up hope of coming home.
What's it like in that moment? What's the internal dialogue?
Actually, I was at peace with it. I never had a fear of dying. I just had a fear of captured and painful dying. The lot of the fellows with me felt the same way.
Well, and we know close to 7,000 Americans were killed on that island. Were there some guys that you had gotten to know that
I was real close with all the people in my squad. Mm-hmm. I visited with them a long time after the war. They'd come and visit me, and I'd go visit them. All of them died off, except for, I'm not sure whether Burg James is still alive in Missouri or not. Mm. And LaSalle, French LaSalle, I haven't heard anything about him in about 10 years. The last I knew, he was still alive in New Iberia, Louisiana.
What about the Marines who were killed there? Were any of your friends among that?
I had a lot of my platoons were killed. Binder and Sherman and Bohannon and a bunch of my Christensen.
These are all guys you knew?
Yeah, we're all killed on Iwo.
How did you process that as an 18-year-old? How did you work through that?
We got to where we accepted it right quick. We accepted death as being a part of life. I never have had a fear of dying.
Why not?
I was raised in this area here where we had a lot of old people passed away, and my mother had always taught me that dying is a part of life. You're born, you live, and you die. And all of creation is circular. It goes in a circle. The stars form, they live, and they die, and something else comes up between them. So everything is cyclic, and I've never had I don't want to die, but I have no particular fear of it. I know it's inevitable, and I was raised that way.
So you mentioned the night where you're surrounded, and you said that's the first time you thought, I'm not going to make it out of here.
Yeah.
Were there some other close calls that you experienced before the day you were wounded?
Yeah, I was digging a foxhole on the north side of an observation hole. It was up on a high place. Our platoon was dug into the lower part of the ridge, and they had a little point come up, and we were asked to go up and push up the rocks and dig us a foxhole on top of this little ridge where we could see the Japanese coming in at night. They'd crawl in and get close to your foxhole, and sometimes they'd jump in with a live grenade and pop a grenade and jump the foxhole with you. Other times they'd get up close and just drop a couple of grenades in your foxhole with you. And they were really wizards at crawling in at night when the star shells were off. They would move ahead a ways, and then they'd cover up that were hard to see. And we dug a observation post with rocks and holes between the rocks so we could look out and not outline our helmets above the rocks. We were digging that foxhole. There was a great big flat sulfur rock in the bottom. I lifted it up and I raised it up, and I had to raise my head above the land over the side of the foxhole for reinforcement. And this Japanese machine gunner cut a layer of rock over, hit that rock, and blew gravel in my face. He'd have been a tenth of an inch higher, he'd have cut me in two.
A tenth of an inch?
Yeah.
That's pretty close. If that rock hadn't have been there,
if
I guess,
If that rock hadn't been there, I wouldn't have made it.
Yeah. Wow.
I had several close calls. I had lots of bullets pass within 6 inches of me. You could hear the crack of the bullet and feel the pressure, the air pressure. Then I got out of the Marine Corps. I was still in the Marine Corps when my folks called me and told me this piece of property I'm living on now is for sale. So they went ahead and bought it, and then I paid for it after the GI loan after I got out of the service. And I've kept this for retirement property ever since. I got out of the Marine Corps, went back to work for the Naval Police Department, took some non-credit college courses, and finished my GED in high school, and went into game management. I worked for them for 32 years. Then after I left the Game and Fish Department, we formed the first ambulance service. My wife was a nurse at the hospital down the road here. She was out there. She was working one day, and a guy had an accident up a canyon. She took my station wagon and went up there and got the girl out. She was really badly hurt. And they brought in the hospital and stabilizer, and then they hauled her by station wagon on to Albuquerque for more intensive care. A short time later, there was a guy showed up and wanted to see her ambulance. He wanted to thank us for what we did for the daughter. And they pointed the old station wagon out there, and he says, "I'm going to get you a new ambulance." So about a month later, a guy drove up with a new Dodge van, all equipped with gurneys and everything in it, and shelves for medication, for our equipment, and we formed the first ambulance north of Albuquerque.
Wow.
Before that, they'd send the hearse out and pick you up, and if you lived, they took you to the doctor. If you didn't live, they took you to the morgue. So we had the first ambulance service. It was a busy service.
Wow. Well, there's so many directions we can go here.
Manned by volunteer EMTs.
Well, you talked about a couple close calls there on EWO, but I've got to hear about the day you were wounded. Do you remember what day that was?
Yeah, that was March 15th, 1945.
And we'll hear the story of that day when we come back, celebrating the lives of two exemplary World War II veterans, Walter Granger and Carl Berghofer, not just for their service to their country as teenagers, but their impact in the communities they dedicated their lives to as well. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring the legacy of two special World War II veterans who recently left us at the age of 99. A celebration of Walter Granger's life will take place October 4th in his native Bakersfield, California, while Carl Berghofer's legacy is being honored this weekend in New Mexico, where we had the privilege of catching him in action a few years ago. He was still running his farm along the Rio Grande. 80 years ago, on the Ides of March on Iwo Jima, he was inches away from having his story come to an end as a teenager.
About 10 o'clock in the morning, we were making an advance through the last, up toward Katano Point, with the last hold out of the Japanese troops. We were advancing. It was a beautiful morning. That morning, we had brought us out the new sea rations. We enjoyed a good breakfast. Then they ordered us to move out, and we moved out to L Company and I Company combined, and we had about 20 men left in the two companies, and we made an advance across this. There was a series of ridges and flats and ridges and flats. We went from one ridge to the other. Finally, we came to a ridge, and we were blowing foxholes close as we went, dropping grenades at them. When the shot fired at us, we came up on this little ridge, and we raised up and looked over it, and I was one of the first to look over it. It looked like a mushroom field, Japanese helmets. Wow. And all of them had a rifle pointed at me. And I raised my legs up, and it took me 10 minutes to fall to the ground, and there was just a sheet of bullets came across the top of that ridge. The only way we could fire without getting hit was raise the rifles over his head and empty them in the general direction. And we threw all the grenades we had, and order finally came down for us to withdraw. And there was a flat area behind us and a big rock. So they started running one at a time, zigzagging and getting behind this rock. And I was about the fourth man through. The third man that went through, man, they really opened up on him, and he made it safely. And I made it about three jumps from that rock, and I got hit in the back of the head. I didn't know I got hit. Of course, I was knocked out. And I came to, I was laying on my face, my nose hurt. I thought I'd pull it and hit my nose on a rock. Then I felt the blood, and one of the guys behind the rock said, "Berghofer, you're still moving?" And I don't remember answering him, but he said, "If you can make about three jumps, I can grab you and pull you behind this rock." So I laid there a minute and got my equilibrium back, and I got to my feet, and he reached out and grabbed me.
Wow.
And I evacuated myself back to base hospital. When I got back to the base hospital, I was treated by Dr. Raymond, and he was a surgeon from Santa Fe.
How about that?
I met with him several times after the war.
So what was the extent of your injuries?
I got a bullet hit in the back of my head. It was a glancing blow, but it pulled out a little piece of bone. He treated it and put a plate in it. It was supposed to be silver, but I don't think it was. But it's since disappeared. It's been absorbed.
So you get hit. It knocks you unconscious.
Yeah.
You're lying on the ground.
Yeah.
They still have a line of sight on you, right?
I was still on the ground, so they quit shooting at me.
Right. Because you weren't moving, they stopped shooting.
Yeah.
If you had been moving, they probably would have shot you a few more times.
Yeah, they would have shot me again.
So it's a good thing you got knocked out.
Yeah.
Maybe saved your life.
Yeah.
And then you come to, and you don't know what happened.
I didn't know what happened. I thought I'd fall and hit my head on a rock.
Because when you fell, I'm sure you did hit something.
I broke my nose, I know.
Broke your nose.
And I thought that was where the blood was coming from, but then I realized it was running down the side of my head. Head wounds bleed real bad.
And so it penetrated your helmet and the liner?
Yeah, it went through my helmet in one side and out the other. Knocked a little 25 caliber hole going in. Some of my friends brought the helmet back to me on Guam. When they came back.
So when you're in the hospital recovering, they show up and give you the helmet?
I was in the hospital, and then I'd gone back to duty, and we were putting up the tents and everything for the Marines returning from Iwo. I was on duty already back on duty when they came back.
And so they gave you the helmet with two holes in it?
Yeah, I brought the helmet back, and I lost it somewhere in transit.
Oh, man. Well, again, I'm still just fascinated by this circumstance. You're 18 years old, you're shot in the head, you're unconscious, you come to, you're trying to figure out what happened.
Yeah.
And you know that the Japanese can still shoot you at any moment.
Yeah.
And your buddy's telling you, try to move over here and I'll grab you.
Yeah. He says, Berkhofer, can you hear me? And I must answer him somehow. He says, if you could make about two jumps, he says, I can grab you. So I laid there and flexed myself. I remember that. And then I got to my feet, or I don't remember where I got clear to my feet or not. Anyway, I got up where I could jump and made about two or three jumps, and he grabbed me and pulled me higher that rock. And the Japanese never did shoot at me.
But you knew you were going to be exposing yourself to that fire by jumping over there.
Yeah.
How far do you think you had to go?
About 6 or 8 feet.
So then you're able to walk and move fine. You just have blood coming out of your head.
After I got back there, they bandaged me up, and I evacuated myself.
You had to be in pain.
Now, those medical corpsmen I'm telling you, they were great people. They were great people. They were going in unarmed. A lot of them were Navy.
Right.
Medical corpsmen attached to the Marine unit. I remember when they'd get a mass casualties, they'd borrow morphine. We carried a little pouch on our thing it had a roller bandage and a pack of dressing and a tube of morphine and a sofa.
Right.
In each one of your little packs we carried on our belt, on a cartridge belt. He'd go around and borrow morphine from different people in the sofa because they didn't have enough in his pack to supply all the needs. And then we'd send back and he'd get replenishments. So, and one of the duties I dreaded on Iwo Jima was stretcher bearer duty. We'd pick up the wounded, sometimes the dead, and we'd carry them back to off the lines and back to a safe area, sometimes clear down to the beach to the hospital ships. And the hospital ships, and they set up a tent, field hospital on Iwo. That's what I went to. But we'd carry, and we'd have two men to a stretcher. We'd put a man on a stretcher, and we'd run from one rock or foxhole to the next and dive in the hole. We were under fire at that time. And we'd get them back out of the firing area, and then we'd carry them down to the beach. And on the return trip, we'd pick up water and gasoline from flamethrowers and extra ammunition and grenades and carry the loaded stretcher back to the lines. The stretcher duty was a hard duty, but I was on stretcher duty about 2 to 3 times a day.
And then, so when you get hit and you get yourself back to the field hospital.
Yeah.
And you told the surgeon from Santa Fe.
Yeah.
Put the plate in your head. Did you think you might get to go home?
I didn't think so at that time. But that time they didn't know about subdural hematomas.
Hmm.
Where you get a blow on one side of the head and the bruising is on the opposite side. And I suffered from severe headaches for months over my right temple. And actually, they were bad enough where I passed out a couple of times. And I was finally, after they dropped the atom bombs on Japan, I was immediately back to the States and given a medical discharge.
Well, I've got to ask you, too. I mean, the situation where you're digging that spot out and you set the rock up on the edge and you said you were a tenth of an inch away from being killed there.
Well, maybe an inch.
Maybe an inch.
If he'd have been an inch higher, he'd have cut me in two.
How about when you got hit? What do you think the margin was there for you surviving versus getting killed?
Well, looking backwards now, in hindsight, I would say I had a 50-50 chance.
Because if he's a little lower, he could sever your spinal cord?
Without getting hit. And I had a good chance of being wounded.
I mean, I'm just thinking, if a bullet hits the back of your head, it's not very far from ending it for you right there.
Yeah, if he'd have led me just a speck more, he'd have caught me. He didn't realize how fast I was running.
I guess that's it.
Yeah.
How often have you thought about that over the years? Because now you've lived another...
I still have dreams about that. Every once in a while, I have dreams about that damn place.
You know, I'm not trying to be dramatic or put thoughts in your head, but when you come that close to being killed at 18 years old, and now you look back, you know, the life you've had and the children and the grandchildren and all the impact you've had through your career and how many people you've fed through this farm, how do you account for all that? How do you size up what happened there and why?
I'll tell you what it did. Teach me compassion. That's one thing I learned out of that Marine Corps experience was compassion from a fellow man.
I'm sure there's been a few times, you know, in all these years that you've seen that famous photo that Rosenthal took of those Marines raising that flag.
I've got pictures of it.
When you see that, what does it bring to mind for you?
Well, I remember all the people that were all in the service with me. Ira Hayes had helped raise the flag on Iwo Jima.
Right.
He was a Pima Indian, Apache Pima. I really admired him. I looked up to him. He was brought against his will. He wanted to stay with his unit. He was brought against his will and went into war bond drive. And where they plied him with lots of whiskey and lots of food, and he wasn't used to that. I remember when he died, I felt real bad about it. He died in January in an irrigation ditch on the Pima Reservation, froze to death. I really felt bad about that.
Yeah, it was a tragic story.
He was a good man. It was all pours on him.
You mentioned that, you know, you had headaches for months after your injury. Have there been any other lasting effects of what happened to you?
No lasting effects. I went in and had a bone scan here about 10 years ago. I've lived a very active life. I broke a lot of bones. And they said that head wound is completely cleaned up, healed up, and no sign of the plates that they were supposed to put in it. So I guess it was, they said they think it was probably absorbed it over the period of years.
It's been a long time.
But the headaches gradually went away after about, it was about a year.
I've heard a lot of Marines say, once a Marine, always a Marine.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Right today, I'm proud of the Corps. If I was to go in again, I would enlist the Marines. My younger son was in the Marines. He was in the 9th Regiment in Vietnam. He was wounded over there, and he died in a car wreck about 30 days after he came home. Mm.
Yeah, your family has quite a legacy of service, doesn't it?
Yeah, starting with my ancestral family, Jost Harbaugh came over from Kaiserslautern, Germany, settled in Pennsylvania, and his sons were involved in the French-Indian War. One of them was killed during Braddock's debacle. Then he was in they fought on the Patriot side during the Revolutionary War, and my great-grandfather came from Hesse in Germany, and he was in the war with Mexico. He came in here with the Mormon battalions that came in. He wasn't a Mormon, but he was with the Missouri Mounted Cavalry, and they went on to California. And then my grandfather was in the Spanish-American War with Cuba. My father was in World War I, and I was in World War II. My brother was in the Korean War, and I had two sons in the Vietnam War, and then I've had grandkids that served in the Gulf War.
Hasn't missed any generations, has it?
Yeah, well, we've had generations of people that volunteer for the service.
Well, when you think about that, especially with your generation, you know, I think about what you told me, that you had 240 men in your company going into Iwo Jima. And by the end of that campaign, there were only 11 who hadn't been
killed. 11 of the original people. We'd been replaced three or four times.
Because those are all casualties.
Yeah, the casualties were replaced with raw recruits. And we'd been replaced three or four times. So actually, our company probably suffered 120% casualties.
Which seems impossible, but it's not. Well, and I don't mean to make light of that, because this is life or death. These are high stakes. And just those statistics you cite tell us that the odds were not in your favor, right? You had to beat some significant odds to survive.
Well, I probably had an 80% chance of being wounded and about a 20% chance of being killed on Iwo.
Have you ever tried to answer the question why? Or how? Why or how you survived?
I was attributed to luck. I was just lucky. And I was well trained to keep undercover and use the terrain as much as I could for protection. And I had been raised in the outdoors and hunting and trapping and farming and my time in the game and fish department. So I was pretty well, I was in good physical shape. The practice of animals, practice with people. Learning how to hide and conceal and when to run and when not to. And
I'm sure when you were on Iwo, you saw some of the crosses there.
Yeah, I went down to visit the cemetery before I left Iwo. Before I got wounded, in fact, I see just lines and lines of crosses.
Well, how should those guys be remembered?
They should be remembered as guys that didn't want to go, but went because they were asked to, and it was their duty to go. They sacrificed themselves for a good cause. If the Army and the Navy and the Marine Corps hadn't won World War II, we'd be a Japanese and German-speaking nation right today. People never know how close we come to losing World War II. That's my own opinion. Hitler made a few mistakes, serious mistakes, It cost him the war. One thing, he made a mistake of not taking Iceland and following the invasion into England, because England had very little in the way of defense. If he'd have followed his attack after Dunkirk and gone on into England, they couldn't have repelled him. And if he'd have taken England and Iceland, we wouldn't have had any way of defeating him from American shores.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story.
Don't think of thanking me, because it was just part of my duty, you know, young life. I'm thankful for my life, with my family and my wife and my kids. I've had a good life, actually. I've lived a good life. I've been active all my life, and I can't complain.
And he was impactful to the end, the one and only Carl Berghofer, whose legacy in New Mexico's Embuto Valley will carry on for generations, just as Walter Granger's will in California's Kern County. Two men whose service in World War II, followed by decades of service to their communities, give us an example to follow. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.